Hello, it's Tuesday the 23rd of February and welcome to Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. South Korea has stressed consultation with the US and other countries will be needed to release frozen Iranian assets under US sanctions. That comes after Tehran unilaterally announced that an agreement had been reached with Seoul on the transfer and use of those assets. We'll have the details in our news briefing shortly. Meanwhile, South Korea has expressed deep concern on the military coup in Myanmar after two protesters were killed on Saturday. We'll look closer at the situation for our in-depth. And then later, for Touch Base in Seoul, we'll be speaking to Tae Keller, the latest winner of the Newbery Medal Award for her book When You Trap a Tiger, inspired by Korean folktales. Let's begin Korea 24. Iran announced on Tuesday that it's reached a deal with South Korea that will allow them to recover assets at South Korean banks frozen under US sanctions. However, South Korea claims that they have yet to finalize such a deal. Here to discuss this and the rest of the day's headlines, we have a new voice joining our show now, KBS World Radio news editor, Gu Hee-jin. Hello and welcome to Korea 24.
Hello, Jang-ho.
So let's start with Tehran's unexpected announcement that it reached an agreement with Seoul over its frozen assets at South Korean banks. So what do they say exactly?
Well, according to Iran's state-run news agency IRNA and its official website, the two sides finalized a deal on Monday in a meeting that was held at the South Korean embassy in Tehran between the Iranian governor of the central bank, Abdulnazar Hamati, and South Korean ambassador Yoo Jung-hyun. Iran said that the two sides agreed to the transfer of the frozen assets and that the Central Bank of Iran would notify Seoul of how much and where to send these funds. Now, Iran's frozen assets in South Korea are estimated at around $7 billion US dollars.
Right, but the South Korean government has come out and said that the two sides have yet to finalize a deal.
Oh, that's right. According to South Korean news report citing an unidentified foreign ministry official, they have yet to finalize the deal. Joseon-Ilbo, Yonhap, and other outlets reported this particular official is saying that the deal still required consultations with U.S. officials before the funds can be released.
Yes, the U.S. and Iran have been at loggerheads over this issue, which has only escalated with the incoming Biden administration, mm-hmm. and it also led to the apparent seizing of the oil tanker recently as well. Meanwhile, U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken, who has previously touched on the possibility of applying the Iranian solution to resolve North Korea's nuclear issue, said yesterday that the U.S. is prepared to return to the Iran nuclear deal if Tehran agrees to a strict compliance to such a deal. Can you tell us more?
Yes, indeed. His latest comments made during a U.N.-backed conference on disarmament in Geneva indicated that Washington may be ready to revive a deal rejected during the previous Trump administration, even as Tehran appears to be backing further away from it.
And Blinken also reiterated his commitment to denuclearize North Korea. Let's listen to what he said regarding Iran and North Korea.
The United States remains committed to ensuring that Iran never acquires a nuclear weapon. Diplomacy is the best path to achieve that goal. The United States also remains focused on denuclearization of North Korea and will work closely with allies and partners to address Pyongyang's illicit weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missile programs.
So it seems the Biden administration is remaining firm regarding its intent to denuclearize North Korea then.
Oh, it appears so. Both the State Secretary as well as Biden's National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, have previously said that the U.S. is reviewing its North Korea policy across the board, from sanctions to incentives to resolve this issue.
And of course, a part of that effort ties in with the alliance between the US and South Korea. The Pentagon yesterday reaffirmed that it will work closely with South Korea on combined military drills.
Yes, the Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby told reporters at a briefing on Monday that the U.S. remains in close discussions with South Korea regarding the joint drills slated for March. However, he refused to comment on South Korean President Moon Jae-in's recent remarks that Seoul may consult with Pyongyang on these drills if necessary, saying that he was not familiar with such reports. And as our listeners may recall, these joint drills were suspended ever since former President Trump's summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un back in 2018. Now, Kirby did reiterate South Korea's role as a linchpin for the region, adding that Washington takes its commitment to the alliance very seriously.
Now, turning closer to home, last week we reported on a North Korean defector who breached South Korean shores. We have reports now that the South Korean military failed to notice this defector 8 out of 10 times he appeared on surveillance cameras. Can you tell us more about this concerning development?
Yes. Well, the Joint Chiefs of Staff today announced that its military missed detecting this North Korean defector who appeared on closed-circuit TV when he landed on South Korea's eastern shores last week. And the man is believed to have swum across from North Korea via the East Sea overnight, wearing a hard hat and diving suit. Now, after reaching the shore near an observatory in South Korea at around 1 a.m. on February 16th, the man passed through a drainage conduit beneath the barbed wire fences set up along the shore.
Yes, so the military has been caught off guard by recent defections as well. There was one in 2012 when a defector who knocked at a guard post along the DMZ with some questioning the monitoring capability readiness and the nation's military in recent years. Let's move on and turn to the latest on the COVID-19 situation here in South Korea. The number of new cases stayed below 400 for the second consecutive day. And we also have some good news on the vaccine front. Can you tell us more?
Yes, the Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency said on Tuesday that South Korea reported 357 new cases, bringing the country's accumulated total to 87,681, with more than 75% of the local cases coming from the greater metro area. Now, out of these new cases, 330 were local transmissions, while 27 were imported. And the Ministry of Food and Drug Safety announced that its first group of experts assessed the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccine, the COVID-19 vaccine that they deem it effective enough to receive approval for mass distribution. And the panel studied the safety and effectiveness of the vaccine by going over the results of clinical trials conducted in 6 countries, including the U.S. And of the 43,448 people who took part in these trials, nearly 22% were 65 or older.
Well, that is where we wrap it up for our news briefing today. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
Coming up next, in-depth news analysis. You're listening to Korea 24 from KBS World Radio.
Tens of thousands of people returned to the streets in Myanmar on Tuesday as demonstrations continued against the military coup that took place on February 1st. People gathered despite 2 deaths on Saturday after police opened fire on the protesters and despite the military junta's ominous warnings that there could be further loss of life. Countries around the world, including South Korea, have expressed concerns over the situation and are pressuring the military not to let the situation descend into further violence. To get some expert analysis on what's happening in Myanmar and what lies ahead for the country, we're joined on the line now by Michael Charney, Professor of Asian and Military History at SOAS University of London. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
First off, could you give us some background on the February 1st military coup in Myanmar? What led to the coup and how did it take place?
Well, the more immediate circumstances are that they had elections in November, and the NLD, the National League for Democracy, did much better than the military expected. Immediately, they claimed that there was election fraud. Now, I have to point out that Myanmar is a developing country. The technology with which they tabulate election results is very faulty. Both sides, certainly the military, also engaged in election fraud, and so the military used the examples that there were a lot of irregularities in the voting to claim that there was election fraud. They made the complaint to the Union Electoral Commission, which made their decision in the last week of January that the elections were not faulty. One of the problems was, that the head of the Union Electoral Commission is sympathetic to Aung San Suu Kyi. So the military, in the days leading up to the coup, the military demanded that Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD agree to delay taking seats in the Hwat Daw and so on until an investigation could take place. And Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD refused to delay this. And then the military moved. Mm. The military didn't overthrow the whole government. They just removed the NLD, chief NLD members.
You said that the military were not happy with the results of the election. Can you explain a bit more for us the role that the military plays in Myanmar over the last few decades?
Well, the military has had control in Myanmar since 1962, and this current government was the result of a 2008 constitution that was promulgated in 2010, which was supposed to put Burma on the path to eventual full democracy. There were control mechanisms put in place so that the military would not lose a strong degree of control. They were given a certain number of seats automatically in their version of the National Assembly. There was a requirement that they had enough of a voice in Parliament, they could veto any measure that would work against their continuing influence. They were given several ministries, controlled some ministries that involved control of borderlands and national security and this kind of thing. Mm. There were also provisions that in the case of a national emergency, the military could take over as it has right now and take control of the country, the government, for a year to sort things out. Mm. And so that's why they try to put a constitutional facade on what's happened.
Okay, and what do the military leaders want from this coup? What do they want to try and get out of it?
What they feel is that the way in which the NLD has participated was going to lead to substantial changes that would remove their control mechanisms. Over the course of last year, Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD have said that once they had more of a mandate from the people, as they got in November, that they would undertake significant constitutional changes. One of them would be to change the provision that bars Aung San Suu Kyi from being officially the president. The military, in moving, they don't want to end the democratic experiment. They want to turn the clock back and start it all over again, ensuring that there will be no new, that the NLD will not be part of the process this time, Aung San Suu Kyi will not be part of the process, and that civilian parties will remain so small that the military will have an easy time turning them against each other. Their problem is that the NLD is such a huge force, and they need to break that up.
Can you also briefly explain for us why the military have a problem with Aung San Suu Kyi? What kind of figure is she?
Well, Aung San Suu Kyi, for a long time, she was a symbol of international humanitarian human rights and pushing for democratic change in the country against the harsh military. So she had that kind of symbiology. The other issue is that she has an awful lot of automatic legitimacy in the country because she is the daughter of the founder of the country, General Aung San, a very popular figure who was assassinated in 1947, months before Burma actually got independence. But he was father of the army, father of the country, and as his daughter, there was this feeling that her base of legitimacy would be stronger than theirs. So they have tried very hard since 1988, when she came to the fore, to keep her from holding power directly.
So Aung San Suu Kyi has been detained since the country's military seized control of the country. What's the immediate outlook on the fate of Aung San Suu Kyi?
Well, just to clarify that, she came back to the country in 1988, just as there were revolutions, and so a popular uprising. So she has been in house arrest for much of the period since about 1990, actually. The prospects for her, I don't think, are very good. The military will try very hard to ensure that one way or another she will be barred from running again or playing a political role. And that's why they've created some of the charges that they have, ranging from petty violations of the import-export law to more substantial charges of treason. All of these charges, if she's convicted, even for the export-import law, for having unregistered walkie-talkies, this will prevent her from, it could send her to prison for 3 years on the minimum charge. And if she's convicted, she can't hold office again. So this is also being done against against Win Myint, the deposed president. Mm. And this is, without this kind of leadership, the NLD, the military hopes the NLD will fall apart.
What's the general public's view of Aung San Suu Kyi? Because she has faced international scorn in recent years for defending Myanmar against accusations of genocide against the Rohingya Muslims, hundreds of thousands of whom fled across the border into Bangladesh by military crackdown.
At the time that that occurred, her choice to support the military in this and defend the country won her even more domestic support. She lost international support, but it solidified. It made rock-hard domestic popularity, and she has that now. So the protesters are mainly split between ethnic minorities who are pushing for full democracy and inclusion, and democratic people who support the maintaining of democratic space, but also a large number of people who are really dedicated to her. So you see these three groups who have come together to call for her release, whether it's to preserve democracy per se or to bring her back to leadership.
Okay, then what do you think could end the military coup? Would it require international help at this point?
There is not going to be a lot that the international community can do, and that is because there have been many, many rounds of the military standing up. To international criticism and sanctions and other kinds of measures. They've become very resilient and very desensitized to international criticism. So they won't react very much to international criticism. They've had time to adjust from the impact of sanctions in the past so that their money is now in places and their trade is with places like China and Singapore that will not care so much will not take this as seriously as maybe the West will. It's also a change in international climate. very little. There's very little a chance of any country in the international community would interfere in any more meaningful way, such as military intervention. Many Burmese hope that the Americans that the Americans will invade and save the protesters against the military. That certainly won't happen. In Asia's new geopolitical configuration built around China, Myanmar's important position on the One Belt, One Road relative to China, the fact that there's been a rollback of democracy throughout Southeast Asia, particularly in Cambodia and Thailand and, its main neighbors. Because of all of this, I don't think the international community can or will do very much. Mm. What will end the military coup? It's going to depend on, for obvious reasons, it's either going to depend on the victory of the protesters or the victory of the military. My bet would be that the military is going to win in the end. But it's not going to come without a great deal of bloodshed. They'll try to avoid that as much as possible, because they want to present a new face to themselves. They don't want to be seen as the, in line with other places like Cambodia and Thailand. They don't want to be seen as a harsh military takeover, but more as a disciplined democracy. So they'll try to avoid bloodshed as much as they can. But in the end, the protests just keep on growing. In the end, you're going to have two forces, one of which must prevail, and that will be determined by violence.
Right. As we mentioned, the first deaths from the protests were reported last week. At least two people on Saturday, one on Friday, and I believe a policeman, the military authorities say, has died as well. Do you expect the situation to escalate further then? Is it going to get worse before it gets better?
Yes. The scale of violence I would expect that would eventually happen, and I don't have a crystal ball, but if things continue as they are right now, we may see confrontations that will lead to hundreds, maybe even thousands of casualties. It just depends. It depends on if the military can find another way for the protesters to break. One of the unpredictables here, one of the unpredictable factors, is that the government's coming to a halt. They're going to have economic problems. People will not be paid pretty soon, and we'll have to see when there is severe economic disruption like this. Food stops become available. In those types of situations, does it push the crowds back, or does it encourage them because they have nothing to lose forward? That is when things come to a head, when people don't have money anymore, they aren't being paid, and when they don't have food to eat to put on the table for their families. The protests have kept on growing for the past couple of weeks because that situation has not emerged. But now that we're moving on into the next month, past the end of the month, for many, the end of the month payday, we will see just how committed the majority of the protesters are. And how much whether the lack of food and money will mean that they will become more violent and push against the military in a way that can overwhelm them, or does that get them to go back to their homes and leave the streets? And that's what we'll have to see. We don't know yet because the Burmese people have never gone. They have gotten about this far,
sure,
but they haven't further since the, we're really talking since the colonial period. So we'll just have to see whether this is a game. This is a different time, though.
Very briefly, very briefly, some protesters have accused China of supporting the military coup. Conspiracy theories swirl that Beijing sent soldiers over the border and that Chinese technicians and helped the military build internet firewalls. What do you make of these claims? And could China play a role in resolving this situation?
China could have played a role in resolving the situation, and they tried to. Apparently, they tried to behind the scenes talks between the military and the NLD for several days before the coup actually happened. Some of the claims that China has interfered have focused on soldiers who appeared to have lighter skin than other Burmese, but Myanmar has hundreds of thousands of Sino-Burmese, Chinese migrants to the country from the colonial period. And they have, including all the different ethnic minorities, they have the whole range of skin tones, many of these people in the military. So that alone is not, that has sparked much of the rumors. Mm. However, it has been the case that China has always, it prefers actually to work with Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD, but they have an approach of always supporting whichever government is in charge. Mm. In favor of stability. Mm. So the reports that they have helped the Myanmar military by sending technicians to improve their firewall, make it stronger, that is probably true. I would expect that that's true. We've seen information on that. I would expect that's not false, that there is this kind of help, because that's the kind of help that they have given in the past, and they would give in this kind of situation.
And Professor, can you also give us a very brief word on what this coup means for Myanmar's road to democracy?
I think that the road to democracy will be continued on the path that it was originally set by the military, but it will be clarified now that it's not a path to full democracy, but a path to a kind of half-half democracy, where the military will never allow the democratic space to exceed a point where military control will be threatened.
We'll leave it there. We've been speaking to Michael Charney, Professor of Asian and Military History at SOAS University of London. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 9.66 points or 0.31% on Tuesday to close at 3,070.09. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 17.69 points or 1.85% to close at 936.60. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 0.2 won against the dollar, ending the session at 1,110.6 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
We carry on now to our daily segment, Korea Trending. Here we round up some of the other news stories that have been trending online today on Korean web portals, as well as on KBS. Bringing us those stories today is Lee Joo-young, who joins us on the line. Joo-young, hello.
Hello, Donald.
It is a good speak to you, as always. So what topics do you have for us today?
Our first story is about star baseball player Choo Jin-soo, who is set to start a new baseball career in South Korea after serving 16 seasons in the major leagues. We then talk about a foiled robbery that happened in the rural parts of the country. Our last story is about American flags flying on federal buildings in the U.S., marking the grim milestone of over 500,000 deaths in the country from COVID-19.
Okay, let's get started with our first trending topic then. And it's a big one from the Korean sporting world. Joo-young, can you tell us more?
Sure. Longtime Major League outfielder Choo Jin-soo was a major search topic as it was announced today that he's set to join the newly launching KBO club run by E-Mart, still known as the SK Wyverns for now, for an annual salary of 2.7 billion won. This figure would make Choo's annual salary the largest in the Korea baseball organization's history. But in fact, Choo agreed to donate 1 billion won in the form of social contribution. Choo had reportedly been offered contracts from several Major League Baseball teams from the U.S. already, but he decided to return to Korea after much consideration. This will be, in fact, his very first time playing professional baseball in South Korea.
Right, just yesterday we briefly mentioned on our Sports Roundup segment that we were waiting to see which Major League team Choo was going to sign with. So it comes as quite a surprise that he's joining the KBO, signing with E-Mart or Shinsegae or whichever name the team will take. For listeners who may be unfamiliar with Choo, though, can you tell us a little bit more about him and his career?
Sure. The 38-year-old played in the big leagues for 16 seasons, heading straight to the U.S. Rather than first plying his trade in the KBO. Throughout his year in MLB, Choo played with the Seattle Mariners, the Cleveland Indians, the Cincinnati Reds, and the Texas Rangers, racking up 218 home runs throughout his career. Chu had actually been a free agent after 7 seasons with the Rangers at the end of the 2020 season. Chu holds the records for the most home runs and RBIs in MLB by an Asian player.
You mentioned that Chu was offered contracts from multiple MLB clubs, but ultimately decided to play in the KBO. Do we know who offered to take him and why he decided to come back to Korea?
Yes. So the Philadelphia Phillies, the Milwaukee Brewers, and the Colorado Rockies were all interested in signing him on for the 2021 season, but he chose to come back to Korea, saying that he longed to play for the KBO for a long time, and that this will be a new turning point in his baseball career. Chu is set to land in Korea on Thursday this week and will join his club for spring training after his 14-day quarantine.
Well, it's certainly exciting news for fans of the KBO, and it's a statement of intent by the new club as well. As we've said, he's never played in the KBO, so it will be a new experience for him and the fans. But he could make quite a splash. Very interesting indeed. Let's move on to our second trending story of the day now. What do you have for us?
Our second story is from one of KBS's most viewed stories of the day regarding a thief in his 60s that got caught while trying to rob a house in a remote village in South Korea's countryside. The attempted robbery took place last Friday at 1 p.m. in Gwaesang County in North Chungcheong Province, located south of Seoul. The man, who was eventually caught, is said to be handed over to prosecution on charges of house invasion and attempted larceny.
Right, so he was caught, but it was the nature of his capture that caught people's attention, right? Can you tell us more?
Yes. So this is a story of magnificent teamwork, Jiang Ho. When the homeowner, surnamed Wu, noticed a strange man searching his home, he intuitively felt that the person was a thief and started to chase after him. But when the burglar fled, Wu immediately called one of his neighbors, surnamed Hong, and the two started pursuing the felon together. With good knowledge of the topography of the land, Hong predicted the thief's escape route and cut across rice paddies to close in on the convict. And by this time, the police were also involved, and the thief was eventually caught and arrested. The thief told the police that he committed the crime because he was hungry while he bounced around between inns and hotels. The man was, in fact, recently released from prison for theft as well.
Right. I think it could have been quite dangerous for Wu as well as Hong to just start chasing after the housebreaker.
Right.
But they did it anyway.
That's correct. But Wu stated that there was absolutely no hesitation when it came to chasing after the robber, and that the situation could have been much more dangerous if the thief had broken into a house of an older person living alone. Police say that many thieves tend to target homes that are unlocked or homes in rural areas where many older residents live. The police recommended people to turn on the radio when leaving homes for a short while and to not leave any newspapers or milk at the door that would indicate that no one is home.
Sure, chasing after a thief is not recommended as it could get dangerous, as we said. So ultimately avoiding the situation in the first place is perhaps the best course of action. But thankfully, it all worked out this time. Let's move on to our last story of the day now. What are we looking at?
U.S. President Joe Biden ordered American flags to fly at half-mast at federal buildings to mark 500,000 COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. on Monday. This story was trending on South Korean media today as cumulative death tolls in the U.S. is by far the highest reported count of any country in just over a year. According to sources, this is more than the number of Americans killed in World War II. Biden delivered remarks from the White House before a memorial service was held that included a moment of silence and a candlelight ceremony. Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters that the flags will stay at half-mast for 5 days.
Yeah, so Biden offers some very somber remarks, saying, quote, "We have to resist becoming numb to the sorrow." I understand that the White House had made some remarks on the previous administration as well.
Psaki told reporters that the Biden administration, quote, "inherited a circumstance from former U.S. President Donald Trump where there were not enough vaccinations ordered, insufficient manpower nor a proper place for people to go get those vaccinations. And the Washington Post in its report also said that the Biden administration's continued focus on tackling the pandemic is in stark contrast to former President Trump, who repeatedly underestimated the seriousness of COVID-19 and seemed unwilling to lead Americans in paying tribute.
Right. Looking ahead to better news, though, how is the inoculation process going in the U.S.?
Right. There are some signs of hope with millions of people now vaccinated and the massive spike in infections dropping. Earlier this month, President Biden announced that the U.S. has secured contractual commitments from vaccine makers Moderna and Pfizer to deliver 600 million doses by the end of July, which is more than a month earlier than anticipated.
Yes, that does sound like some encouraging news, at least. That is all we have for on today's Career Trending. Thank you for those stories, Chuyong, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you, Zhang-o.
For anyone picking up a book for children, a gold medal on the cover signifying that it won the Newbery Medal Award would be a reassuring mark of quality, making it a must-buy. The award, given by the Association for Library Services to Children, a division of the American Library Association, is one of the oldest, most prestigious awards in children's literature dating back to 1922. And this year's honours went to Tay Keller's When You Trap a Tiger, which has its grounds in Korean folklore. Tell us more about her award-winning book and her career. Tay Keller joins us over the phone from Seattle for this week's Touch Base in Seoul. Ms. Keller, hello. It's a pleasure to have you on the show today.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
First, congratulations on the Newbery Medal. How did you find out that you'd been given the award, and what was your first reaction?
I had my publisher set up a Zoom call for me, so I didn't expect the Zoom call to be with the Newbery Committee, but when I logged on, the Newbery Committee was there, and they told me that my book had won, and I really could not believe it. It took me a while to process it, and I was just totally in shock because this was such a dream that felt so impossible, and I couldn't believe that I had achieved it with this book.
So it was a complete surprise then, it seems. Did you have a favorite Newbery Medal book growing up at all, and how does it feel knowing that with this mark, children from now will grow up reading your book?
I had so many favorite Newbery books. I loved Linda Sue Park's books. I loved Kate DiCamillo. I loved Holes and The Giver. I just had shelves full of these books. And it's stunning to think that I will be alongside of these authors that I have admired my whole life. Mm. Really, I just feel so grateful to the committee for recognizing my book.
Mm. Well, let's talk more about the book, When You Trap a Tiger. Can you tell us more about it? What is it about?
Yeah, so it's about a girl named Lily who has always grown up hearing her hominy's Korean fairy tales. And these are the fairy tales that I grew up hearing about tigers and tricky little girls. And like most kids, Lily believes that these stories are just stories. But then one day, a magical tiger appears in front of her. And that's when she realizes that there's a lot more going on than her hominy ever told her.
Right, when we say hominy, we of course mean the Korean word for grandmother. So the book features a young girl and her hominy. And I understand your grandmother was Korean as well, so there seems to be some parallels to her story and your life.
Yes, yeah. Actually, the first idea for this book came because a few years back, I was talking with her about her childhood in Korea, and she started telling me these stories that I'd never heard from her before, and I realized how much life she had lived and how many stories she had to tell, and I started digging back into my family history and Korean history, and kind of weaving all this into what became When You Trap the Tiger.
So the stories of Korean folktales, did you grow up listening to them, or was this something you talked about, as you said, when you spoke to your grandmother a few years ago?
So when I was younger, she used to tell me all of these Korean folktales.
Right.
And my favorite was the story of the sun and the moon, about these two siblings that run from a tiger and run up into the sky and become the sun and the moon.
Hmm.
And this story in particular always felt so magical to me. I felt like when my grandmother told me that, I could hear tigers pacing outside of the bedroom and scratching at the door, and it really just lit up my imagination.
Okay, so it must have been very personal for you to have written this book and have the book recognized by the Newbery Medal and various other awards. What was the reaction from your grandmother when the book came out and you started getting recognized for this work?
Oh, she's thrilled. She was so happy when I showed her the book for the first time, and I was able to show her the dedication, because the book is dedicated to her.
All right. Okay, so it is dedicated to her, of course. Yes. Now that you've written the book and it is getting out there, what do you want children to take away from reading When You Trap a Tiger?
I hope that they read it and they know that they're not alone.
Hmm.
No matter how difficult the things that they're dealing with are, whether they're dealing with family illness or trying to understand their history or even just the pain of growing up in general, I hope that they read this book and feel seen.
Sure. You have been writing for a few years now. You have a previous book, The Science of Breakable Things. This is, I understand, your second book. What led you to become a writer, especially for children?
Well, I was writing from a very young age. My mom is also a writer, so when she would write her novels, I would sit next to her and write little books about my stuffed animals and do little illustrations. So I've been writing ever since I could hold a pencil.
Mm.
But I started writing specifically for kids because I feel like this age in particular is really challenging. It's the time when you go from childhood into adulthood. And there's a lot of struggle with that. And there's a lot of new experiences and growth. And I feel like books are so important because they can be a guide for children during this time.
So I'm guessing books would have been important for you as well during those years.
Yes, of course.
Mm. Your mother, you mentioned, she is also an award-winning writer. Her name is Nora Okjakela. She won the American Book Award in 1998 for her debut novel, Comfort Woman. How much was an influence... Was your mother an influence for you to becoming a writer?
I always looked up to her, and I was so lucky because I always knew that being a writer was possible.
Mm.
I know a lot of writers who didn't even realize that this was a job that they could have, but from a very young age, my mom showed me that this was possible. And even now, we're very close. She's the first person who reads the drafts of my books, and we talk about writing and storytelling, and I feel very grateful.
Is she quite critical?
She's very supportive, and she always offers very great feedback.
Right, right. Even though your mother, obviously you have this lineage of a family of writers, there must have been still difficult for you to start this career and get your works out there.
Yeah, I mean, I started in publishing, so I was working on books from the other side of it. So I kind of saw how books were made, and I'm very glad that I had that experience, because I know firsthand how much work goes into a book and how many people really work on a book. So I know that I have this whole team, and I'm thankful to all of their support.
When You Trap a Tiger, this book has its basis on Korean folk tales. What does that mean for you to have Korean stories being told as well? As we said, your grandmother is Korean, so you do have a Korean lineage.
Yeah, it feels like such an honor, really, to tell these stories, to introduce these stories to American kids who might not have grown up hearing them, and also to show Korean kids their own culture reflected in stories. I think that's so important, to be able to read a story and to see yourself and your experience.
Sure. Finally, what's next for you? Obviously, you have this award now. Are you working on any new projects? What do you want to do next?
Yeah, I'm actually writing two books, and they'll be coming out next year. So the first book is called Jennifer Chan is Not Alone. It's about bullying and learning how to forgive and searching for life outside of Earth. And the second book is called Mimi Ever After, and it is about a Korean-American girl who finds out how to travel into the world of Western fairy tales. And she tries to change these stories to better reflect her life and her experience.
Well, those sound like some wonderful books to look forward to. And it is a wonderful achievement to win the Newbery Medal. And it was great to speak to you on the show today as well. We've been speaking to Tae Keller, the author of When You Trap a Tiger. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Hello, this is Tiger JK of Drunken Tiger. You are now listening to Korea 24.
We've come now to our closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, where we talk about some interesting reports or features are coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Herald and the Korea Times. Joining me now for that is our staff editor, Mark Wilson. Chair, Mark, it's great to see you.
Good to see you too.
So where are we starting with first?
Right, Jang-ho, have you ever seen the South Korean zombie thriller Train to Busan? I know I have. Three times.
Yes, Train to Busan. It is one of my favorite films of the last few years as well. Classic horror, apocalyptic horror, basically.
Zombies.
The on
running
a train.
Kind, right?
Exactly.
Not the slow kind, the running
exactly.
kind.
Exactly. So yep. Why are we talking about this today?
Well, Kwak Yeon-soo of the Korea Times writes that according to foreign news reports, Train to Busan will get a Hollywood makeover. Kwak writes that the Indonesian director Timo Chayanto, known for the 2018 action thriller The Night Comes for Us, is in talks with U.S. production company New Line to helm the film. Now, Kwak mentions writers and producers, the names of them, but the cast and production schedule have yet to be revealed.
Right. I'm not sure how to quite take this news
hey.
About a remake of a Korean film. I'm wondering how people taking it.
That's a really good question. Kwak writes that some fans are none too pleased to hear about the remake. One went on to say that the Train to Busan is based on subjects like culture, history, and class specific to South Korea, and to just watch the original, right? Now, director Chayanto responded to concerns, saying that nothing will ever top the original Train to Busan, a film that he, quote, bawled his eyes out to. But he went on to say that he, along with fellow producers and writers, made an absolute oath, don't disrespect or disappoint the fans. So we shall see.
Right, we shall see. That all just raises the question then, why do the remake? But I'm sure many fans will be saying. But I guess we will see.
We won't judge it.
The film before it comes out. Mm-hmm. Yes. Let's move on to our second story. What do you have for us?
That would be in the Korea Herald by Im Jang-won, who writes about a new global esports organization picking a South Korean to head it. The International Esports Committee, or the IEC, announced Kim Ok-young as its first director general, who also serves as director general of the International Sports and Tourism Organization's Asia-Pacific branch. The IEC is headquartered in Brussels, Belgium, and consists of members from 40 countries, including members of the European Parliament, the United Nations, and UNESCO. Im writes that the IEC is currently going through the process of gaining recognition as an official international group under the UN. Wow.
Wow, so this is a very serious group. Yep. What does it do exactly? Is it about, I'm guessing, legitimizing esports as a professional gaming industry.
That's right. That's pretty much right on the money. But it's not just an organization that hosts esports tournaments, and that's what Kim said during his inauguration speech. Kim went on to say that there are more plans to establish academies and education centers for future generations to study and work on the global stage. The IEC also announced that a biannual international esports tournament will be held around the world, with the first to take place in South Korea next year.
Yeah, sounds like an interesting organization. You can find out more about it in the Korea Herald tomorrow. That is where we leave it for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for those stories, Mark, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks so much.
And that brings us to the end of today's show as well. Thanks for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow with more news, views and reviews from Korea. Till then, I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and we hope you have a great day. Goodbye.